Chapter 6. The Box in the Closet. It was strange how people didn't talk much about the blackout. Power failures usually aroused lively discussion, with clumps of people collecting on corners and saying to each other, "Where were you when it happened?" and "What's the matter with the electricians? We should kick them out and get new ones," and that sort of thing. This time, it was just the opposite. When Lina went to work the next morning, the street was oddly silent. People walked quickly, their eyes on the ground. Those who did stop to talk spoke in low voices, then hurried on their way. That day, Lina carried the same message 12 times. All the messengers were carrying it. It was simply this, being passed from one person to another. 7 minutes. The power failure had been more than twice as long as any other so far. Fear had settled over the city. Lina felt it like a cold chill. She understood now that Dune had been speaking the truth on assignment day. Ember was in grave danger. The next day, a notice appeared on all the city's kiosks. Town meeting. All citizens are requested to assemble in Harkin Square at 6 p.m. tomorrow to receive important information. Mayor Lemander Cole. What kind of important information, Lina wondered. Good news or bad? She was impatient to hear it. The next day, people streamed into Harkin Square from all four directions, crowding together so close that each person hardly had room to move. Children sat on the shoulders of fathers. Short people tried to push toward the front. Lina spotted Lizzie and called a greeting to her. She saw Vindy Chance, too, who had brought her little brother. Lina had decided to leave Poppy at home with Granny. There was too much danger of losing her in a crowd like this. The town clock began to strike. Six vibrating bongs rang out, and a murmur of anticipation swept through the crowd. People stood on tiptoe, craning to see. The door of the gathering hall opened, and the mayor came out, flanked by two guards. One of the guards handed the mayor a megaphone, and the mayor began to speak. His voice came through the megaphone, both blurry and crackly.
"People of Ember," he said.
He waited. The crowd fell silent, straining to hear.
"People of Ember,"
the mayor said again. He looked from side to side. The light glinted off his bald head. "What did he say?" people whispered urgently. "What did he say? I couldn't hear him." "Slight difficulties," someone said. "Requires great patience from us all."
"But I've got it here,"
the mayor went on. "What?" came the sharp whisper. "What did he say?" Those near the front passed word back. "Making every effort," they said. "Every effort." "Louder," someone shouted. The mayor's voice blared through the megaphone louder, but even less clear. He said, "We can't hear you," someone else yelled. Lina felt a stirring around her, a muttering. Someone pushed against her back, forcing her forward. "He said we mustn't panic," someone said. "He said panic is the worst possible thing. No reason to panic," he said. On the steps of the gathering hall, the two guards moved a little closer to the mayor. He raised the megaphone and spoke again. He bellowed. "Solutions," the people in front called to the people in back. "Solutions are being found," he said. "What solutions?" called a woman standing near Lina. People elsewhere in the crowd echoed what the woman had said. "What solutions?" What solutions? Their cry became a chorus, louder and louder. Again, Lina felt the pressure from behind as people moved forward toward the gathering hall. Jostling arms poked her. Bulky bodies bumped her and crushed her. Her heart began to pound. I have to get out of here, she thought. She started ducking beneath arms and darting into whatever space she could find, making her way toward the rear of the crowd. Noise was rising everywhere. The mayor's voice kept coming in blasts of incomprehensible sound, and the people in the crowd were either shouting angrily or yelping in fear of being squashed. Someone stepped on Lina's foot, and her scarf was half yanked off. For a few seconds, she was afraid she was going to be trampled. But at last, she struggled free and ran up onto the steps of the school. From there, she saw that the two guards were hustling the mayor back through the door of the gathering hall. The crowd roared, and a few people started hurling whatever they could find. Pebbles, garbage, crumpled paper, even their own hats. At the other side of the square, Dune and his father battled their way down Gilly Street. Move fast, his father said. We don't want to be caught up in this crowd. They crossed Broad Street and took the long way home through the narrow lanes behind the school. Father, said Dune as they hurried along. The mayor is a fool, don't you think? For a moment, his father didn't answer. Then he said, He's in a tough spot, son. What would you have him do? Not lie, at least, Dune said. If he really has a solution, he should have told us. He shouldn't pretend he has solutions when he doesn't. Dune's father smiled. That would be a good start, he agreed. It makes me so angry, the way he talks to us, said Dune. Dune's father put a hand on Dune's back and steered him toward the corner. A great many things make you angry lately, he said. For good reason, said Dune. Maybe. The trouble with anger is, it gets hold of you, and then you aren't the master of yourself anymore. Anger is. Dune walked on silently. Inwardly, he groaned. He knew what his father was going to say, and he didn't feel like hearing it. And when anger is the boss, you get... I know, said Dune. Unintended consequences. That's right. Like hitting your father in the ear with a shoe heel.
I didn't mean to.
That's exactly my point. They walked on down Pibb Street. Dune shoved his hands into the pockets of his jacket and scowled at the sidewalk. Father doesn't even have a temper, he thought.
He's as mild as a glass of water. He can't possibly understand.
Lina was running. She'd already dismissed the mayor's speech from her mind. She sped by people on Otterwill Street going back to open their stores and overheard snatches of conversation as she passed.
Expect us to believe? Said one voice.
He's just trying to keep us quiet, said another.
Heading for disaster, said a third.
All the voices shook with anger and fear. Lina didn't want to think about it. Her feet slapped the stones of the street. Her hair flew out behind her. She would go home. She would make hot potato soup for the three of them, and then she would take out her new pencils and draw. She climbed the stairs next to the yarn shop, two at a time, and burst through the door of the apartment. Something was on the floor, just in front of her feet, and she tripped and fell down hard on her hands and knees. She stared. By the open closet door was a great pile of coats and boots and bags and boxes, their contents all spilled out and tangled up. A thumping and rattling came from inside the closet.
Granny?
More thumps. Granny's head poked around the edge of the closet door.
I should have looked in here a long time ago, she said. This is where it would be, of course. You should see what's in here.
Lina gazed around at the incredible mess. Into this closet had been packed the junk of decades, jammed into cardboard boxes, stuffed into old pillowcases and laundry bags, and heaped up in a pile so dense that you couldn't pull one thing out without pulling all the rest with it. The shelf above the coat rack was just as crammed as the space below, mostly with old clothes that were full of moth holes and eaten away by mildew. When she was younger, Lina had tried exploring in this closet, but she never got far. She'd pull out an old scarf that would fall to pieces in her hands, or open a box that proved to be full of bent carpet tacks. Soon she would shove everything back in and give up. But Granny was really doing the job right. She grunted and panted as she wrenched free the closet's packed-in stuff and tossed it behind her. It was clear that she was having fun. As Lina watched, a bag of rags came tumbling out the door, and then an old brown shoe with no laces.
"Granny," said Lina, suddenly uneasy, "where's the baby?"
"Oh, she's here," came Granny's voice from the depths of the closet. "She's been helping me."
Lina got up from the floor and looked around. She soon spotted Poppy. She was sitting behind the couch in the midst of the clutter. In front of her was a small box made of something dark and shiny. It had a hinged lid, and the lid was open, hanging backward.
"Poppy," said Lina, "let me see that."
She stooped down. There was some sort of mechanism on the edge of the lid, a kind of lock, Lina thought. The box was beautifully made, but it had been damaged. There were dents and scratches in its hard, smooth surface. It looked as if it had been a container for something valuable. But the box was empty now. Lina picked it up and felt around in it to be sure. There was nothing inside at all.
"Was there something in this box, Poppy? Did you find something in here?"
But Poppy only chortled happily. She was chewing on some crumpled paper. She had paper in her hands, too, and was tearing it. Shreds of paper were strewn around her. Lina picked one up. It was covered with small, perfect printing. Chapter 7. A Message Full of Holes. It was the printing that sparked Lina's curiosity. It was not handwriting, or if it was, it was the neatest, most regular handwriting she had ever seen. It was more like the letters printed on cans of food or along the sides of pencils. Something other than a hand had written those words, a machine of some kind. This was the writing of the builders, and so this piece of paper must have come from the builders, too. Lina gathered up the scraps of paper from the floor and gently pried open Poppy's fists and mouth to extract the crumpled wads. She put all this into the dented box and carried it to her room. That evening, Granny and the baby were both asleep by a little after 8. Lina had nearly an hour to examine her discovery. She took the scraps from the box and spread them out on the table in her bedroom. The paper was thick. At each torn edge was a fringe of tangled fibers. There were many little pieces, and one big piece, with so many holes that it was like lace. The chewed bits were beyond saving. They were almost a paste. But Lina spread out the big lacy piece and saw that on one edge of it, which was still intact, was a column of numbers. She collected all the dry scraps and puzzled over them for a long time, trying to figure out where they fit into the larger piece. When she had arranged them as well as she could, this was what she had. In strew, R, E-G-R-E-S, this off-fic, doc, in strick, seeker, period of, ears, period, prepara, made for, in ha, city, period, as full, one, EXP, RIV, IP, ORC. 2. done. Marked with E by R. DGE. 3. Eddie, down, I verb, NK. 2. Edge, APPR. 8. Low, period. 4. Axe to the what, R, comma. Find door of bow, cur, period, K-E. Hind small steel pan, the right, period, rem, E-Y, comma, open, do, period. 5. Oat, comma, stocked with neck, U-I-P, E-N-T, period. Back, aunt, S, eat, period. 6. U-S-I, oops, low, E, ter, period. Head, dow, st, period. Us, pa, av, cks, and assist over, rap, period. 7. Approx, 3 hours, period. Dissem, period. Follow, pat, period. Lina could make sense of only a few words here and there. Even so, something about this tattered document was exciting. It was not like anything Lina had ever seen. She stared at the very first word at the top of the page, instru, and she suddenly knew what it must be. She'd seen it often enough at school. It had to be the beginning of instructions. Her heart began knocking at her chest like a fist at a door. She had found something. She had found something strange and important. Instructions for something. But for what? And how terrible that Poppy had found it first and ruined it. It occurred to Lina that this might be what her grandmother had been talking about for so long. Perhaps this was the thing that was lost. But of course, not knowing what had been lost, Granny wouldn't have recognized the box when she saw it. She would have tossed it out of the closet just as carelessly as she tossed everything else. Anyhow, it didn't matter whether this was the thing or not the thing. It was a mystery in itself, whatever it was, and Lina was determined to solve it. The first step was to stick the scraps of paper down. They were so light that a breath could scatter them. She had a little bit of glue left in an old bottle. Painstakingly, she put a dot of glue on each of the scraps and pressed each one into its place on one of her precious few remaining whole sheets of paper. She put another piece of paper on top of this and set the box on top to flatten everything down. Just as she finished, the lights went out. She'd forgotten to keep an eye on the clock on her windowsill. She had to undress and get in bed in the dark. She was too excited to sleep much that night. Her mind whirled around, trying to think what the message she'd found might be. She felt sure it had something to do with saving the city. What if these instructions were for fixing the electricity? Or for making a movable light? That would change everything. When the lights went on in the morning, she had a few minutes before Poppy wakened to work at the puzzle. But there were so many words missing. How could she ever make sense of such a jumble? As she pulled on her red jacket and tied the frayed and knotted laces of her shoes, she thought about it. If the paper was important, she shouldn't keep it to herself. But who could she tell? Maybe the messenger captain. She would know about things like official documents.
Captain Fleary, Lina said when she got to work, would you have time to come home with me later on today? Just for a minute. I found something I'd like to show you.
Found what? Asked Captain Fleary.
Some paper with writing on it. I think it might be important.
Captain Fleary raised her skinny eyebrows. What do you mean, important?
Well, I'm not sure. Maybe it isn't. But would you look at it anyway?
So that evening, Captain Fleary came home with Lina and peered at the bits of paper. She bent down and inspected the writing.
Foal? She said. Axe? Rem? Aunt? What kind of words are those?
I don't know, said Lina. The words are all broken up because Poppy chewed on them.
I see, said Captain Fleary. She poked at the paper. This looks like instructions for something, she said. A recipe, I suppose. Small steel pan. That would be what you use to cook it with.
But who would have such small, perfect writing?
That's the way they wrote in the old days, said Captain Fleary. It could be a very old recipe.
But then why would it have been kept in this beautiful box?
She showed the box to Captain Fleary.
I think it was locked up in here for some reason, and you wouldn't lock up something unless it was important.
But Captain Fleary didn't seem to have heard her. Or, she said, it could be a school exercise, someone's homework that never got turned in.
But have you ever seen paper like this? Doesn't it look as if it came from someplace else, not here?
Captain Fleary straightened up. A look of puzzlement came over her face. There is nowhere but here, she said. She put both her hands on Lina's shoulders. You, my dear, are letting your imagination run away with you. Are you overtired, Lina? Are you anxious? I could put you on short days for a while.
No, said Lina. I'm fine, I am. But I don't know what to do about...
She gestured toward the paper. Never mind, said Captain Fleary. Don't think about it. Throw it away. You're worrying too much. I know, we all are. There's so much to worry about, but we mustn't let it unsettle us. She gave Lina a long look. Her eyes were the color of dishwater. Help is coming, she said.
Help?
Yes, coming to save us.
Who is?
Captain Fleary bent down and lowered her voice, as if telling a secret. Who built our city, dear?
The builders, said Lina.
That's right. And the builders will come again and show us the way.
They will?
Very soon, said Captain Fleary.
How do you know?
Captain Fleary straightened up again and clapped a hand over her heart. I know it here, she said. And I have seen it in a dream. So have all of us. All the believers.
So that's what they believe, Lina thought. And Captain Fleary is one of them.
She wondered how the captain could feel so sure about it, just because she'd seen it in a dream. Maybe it was the same for her as the sparkling city was for Lina. She wanted it to be true. The captain's face lit up. I know what you must do, dear. Come to one of our meetings. It would lift your heart. We sing.
Oh, said Lina. Thank you, but I'm not sure I... Maybe sometime.
She tried to be polite, but she knew she wouldn't go. She didn't want to stand around waiting for the builders. She had other things to do. Captain Fleary patted her arm. No pressure, dear, she said. If you change your mind, let me know. But take my advice. Forget about your little puzzle project. Lie down and take a nap. Clears the mind. Her narrow face beamed kindness down at Lina. You take tomorrow off, she said. She raised a hand goodbye and went down the stairs. Lina took advantage of her day off to go to the supply depot to see Lizzie Biscoe. Lizzie was quick and smart. She might have some good ideas. At the supply depot, crowds of shopkeepers stood in long, disorderly lines that stretched out the door. They pushed and jostled and snapped impatiently at each other. Lina joined them, but they seemed so frantic that they frightened her a little. They must be very sure now that the supplies are running out, she thought, and they're determined to get what they can before it's too late. When she got close to the head of the line, she heard the same conversation several times. Sorry, the clerk would say when a shopkeeper asked for 10 packets of sewing needles, or 12 drinking glasses, or 20 packages of light bulbs. There's a severe shortage of that item. You can have only one. Or else the clerk would say, sorry, we're out of that entirely. Forever? Forever. Lina knew that it hadn't always been this way. When Ember was a young city, the storerooms were full. They held everything the citizens could want. So much, it seemed the supplies would never run out. Lina's grandmother had told her that school children were given a tour of the storerooms as part of their education. They took an elevator from the street level to a long, curving tunnel with doors on both sides and other tunnels branching off it. The guide led the tour down the long passages, opening one door after another. This area, he would say, is canned goods. Next, we come to school supplies, and around this bend we have kitchenware. Next come carpentry tools. At each door, the children crowded against each other to see.
Every room had something different, Granny told Lina. Boxes of toothpaste in one room, bottles of cooking oil, bars of soap, boxes of pills. There were 20 rooms just for vitamin pills. One room was stacked with hundreds of cans of fruit. There was something called pineapple. I remember that one especially.
What was pineapple? Asked Lina.
It was yellow and sweet, said Granny, with a dreamy look in her eyes. I had it 4 times before we ran out of it.
But these tours had been discontinued long before Lina was born. The storerooms, people said, were no longer a pleasure to look at. Their dusty shelves stood mostly empty now. It was rumored that in some rooms, nothing was left at all. A child seeing the rooms where powdered milk had been stored, or the rooms that stored bandages or socks or pins or notebooks, or, most of all, the dozens of rooms that had once held thousands of light bulbs, would not feel, as earlier generations of children had, that Ember was endlessly rich. Today's children, if they were to tour the storerooms, would feel afraid. Thinking about all this, Lina waited in the line of people at Lizzie's station. When she got to the front, she leaned forward with her elbows on the counter and whispered,
Lizzie, can you meet me after you're through with work? I'll wait for you right outside the door.
Lizzie nodded eagerly. At 4 o'clock, Lizzie came trotting out the office door. Lina said to her,
Will you come home with me for a minute? I want to show you something.
Sure,
said Lizzie, and as they walked, Lizzie talked.
Oh, my wrist is killing me from writing all day, she said. You have to write in the tiniest letters to save paper, so I get a terrible cramp in my wrist and my fingers, and people are so rude. Today they were worse than ever. I said to some guy, You can't have 15 cans of corn. You can only have 3. And he said, Look, don't tell me that. I saw plenty of cans in the Pott Street Market just yesterday. And I said, Well, that's why there aren't so many left today. And he said, Don't be smart with me, Carrot Head. But what am I supposed to do? I can't make cans of corn out of thin air.
They passed through Harkin Square, around the gathering hall, and down Roving Street, where 3 of the floodlights were out, making a cave of shadow.
Lizzie, said Lina, interrupting the flow of talk, is it true about light bulbs?
Is what true?
That there aren't very many left?
Lizzie shrugged.
I don't know. They hardly ever let us go downstairs into the storerooms. All we see are the reports that the carriers turn in. How many forks in room 1146? How many doorknobs in 3291? How many children's shoes in 2249?
But when you see the report for the light bulb rooms, what does it say?
I never get to see that one, said Lizzie. That one, and a few other ones like the vitamin report. Only a few people can see.
Who?
Oh, the mayor, and of course, oh, Flab Face.
Lina looked at her questioningly.
You know, Farlow Batten, the head of the storerooms. He is so mean, Lina. You would just hate him. He counts us late if we come in even 2 minutes after 8, and he looks over our shoulders as we're writing, which is awful because he has bad breath, and he runs his finger over what we've written and says, "This word is illegible. That word is illegible. These numbers are illegible." It's his favorite word, illegible.
When they came to Lina's street, Lina ducked her head in the door of the yarn shop and said hello to Granny, and then they climbed the stairs to the apartment. Lizzie was talking about how hard it was to stand up all day, how it made her knees ache, how her shoes pinched her feet. She stopped talking long enough to say hello to Eveline Murdo, who was sitting by the window with Poppy on her lap, and then she began again as Lina led her into her bedroom.
"Lina, where were you when the big blackout came?" she asked.
But she went right on without waiting for an answer.
"I was at home, luckily, but it was scary, wasn't it?"
Lina nodded. She didn't want to talk about what had happened that day.
"Oh, I hate those blackouts," Lizzie went on. "People say there's going to be more and more of them and that someday."
She stopped, frowned, and started again.
"Anyway, nothing bad happened to me. After that, I got up and figured out a whole new way to do my hair."
It seemed to Lina that Lizzie was like a clock wound too tightly and running too fast. She'd always been a little this way, but today she was more so than ever. Her gaze skipped from one spot to another, her fingers twiddled with the edge of her shirt. She looked paler than usual, too. Her freckles stood out like little smudges of dirt on her nose.
"Lizzie,"
said Lina, beckoning toward the table in the corner of her room.
"I want to show you."
But Lizzie wasn't listening.
"You're so lucky to be a messenger, Lina," she said. "Isn't it fun? I wish I could have been one. I would have been so good at it. My job is so boring."
Lina turned and looked at her. "Isn't there anything you like about it?" Lizzie pursed her lips in a tiny smile and looked sideways at Lina.
"There's one thing," she said.
"What?"
"I can't tell you. It's a secret."
"Oh," said Lina. "Then you shouldn't have mentioned it at all," she thought.
"Maybe I'll tell you someday," said Lizzie. "I don't know."
"Well, I like my job," Lina said. "But what I wanted to talk to you about was what I found yesterday. It's this." She lifted the box away and took up the piece of paper, covering the patched-together document. Lizzie gave it a quick look.
"Is it a message someone gave you that got torn up?"
"No, it was in our closet. Poppy was chewing on it, that's why it's torn up. But look at the writing on it. Isn't it strange?"
"Uh-huh,"
said Lizzie.
"You know who has beautiful handwriting? Myla Bone, who works with me. You should see it. It's got curly tails and the Y's and the G's and fancy loops in the capital letters. Of course, Flabface hates it. He says it's illegible."
Lina slid the piece of paper back over the pasted down scraps. She wondered why she had thought Lizzie would be interested in what she'd found. She'd always had fun with Lizzie, but their fun was usually with games. Hide and seek, tag, the kinds of games where you run and climb. Lizzie had never been much interested in anything that was written on paper. So Lina quietly put the document back in its place, and she sat down with Lizzie on the floor. She listened and listened until Lizzie's chatter ran down.
"I'd better go," Lizzie said. "It was fun to see you, Lina. I miss you."
She stood up. She fluffed her hair.
What was it you wanted to show me? Oh, yes, the fancy writing. Really nice. Lucky you to find it. Come and see me again soon, all right? I get so bored in that office."
Lina made beet soup for dinner that night, and Poppy spilled hers and made a red lake on the table. Granny stared into her bowl, stirring and stirring the soup with her spoon, but she didn't eat. She didn't feel quite right, she told Lina. After a while, she wandered off to bed. Lina cleaned up the kitchen quickly. As soon as her chores were out of the way, she could get back to studying her document.
She washed Poppy's clothes. She sewed on the buttons that had come off her messenger jacket. She picked up the rags and sacks and boxes and bags that Granny had tossed out of the closet. And by the time she had done all this and put Poppy to bed, she still had almost half an hour to study the fragments of paper. She sat down at her desk and uncovered the document. With her elbows on either side of it and her chin resting in her hands, she pored over it. Though Lizzie and Captain Fleary had paid it no attention, Lina still thought this torn-up page must be important. Why else would it have been in such a cleverly fastened box? Maybe she should show it to the mayor, she thought reluctantly. She didn't like the mayor. She didn't trust him either. But if this document was important to the future of the city, he was the one who should know about it. Of course, she couldn't ask the mayor to come to her house. She pictured him puffing up the stairs, squeezing through the door, looking disapprovingly at the clutter in their house, recoiling from Poppy's sticky hands. No, it wouldn't do. But she didn't want to take her carefully patched together document to the gathering hall, either. It was just too fragile. The best thing to do, she decided, was to write the mayor a note. She settled down to do this. She found a fairly unspoiled half piece of paper, and using a plain pencil, she wasn't going to waste her colored ones on the mayor, she wrote, "Dear Mayor Cole, I have discovered a document that was in the closet. It is instructions for something. I believe it is important because it is written in very old printing. Unfortunately, it got chewed up by my sister, so it is not all there. But you can still read some bits of it, such as, marked with E, find door of bow, small steel pan. I will show you this document if you want to see it. Sincerely yours, Lina Mayfleet, Messenger, 34 Quilliam Square." She folded the note in half and wrote, "Mayor Cole" on the front. On her way to work the next morning, she took it to the gathering hall. No one was sitting at the guard's desk, so Lina left the note there, placed so that the guard would see it when he arrived. Then, feeling that she had done her duty, she went off to her station. Several days went by. The messages Lina carried were full of worry and fear. "Do you have any extra baby drink? I can't find it at the store. Have you heard what they're saying about the generator? We can't come tonight. Grandpa B won't get out of bed." Every day when she got home from work, Lina asked Granny, "Did a message come for me?" But there was nothing. Maybe the mayor hadn't gotten her note. Maybe he'd gotten it and paid no attention. After a week, Lina decided she was tired of waiting. If the mayor wasn't interested in what she'd found, too bad for him. She was interested. She would figure it out herself. Twice during the week, when Poppy and Granny were both asleep, she'd had a little free time. She'd spent this time making a copy of the document, in case anything happened to the fragile original. It had taken her a long time. She used one of her few remaining pieces of paper, an old label, slightly torn, from a can of peas. The copy was as accurate as she could make it, with the missing bits between the letters carefully indicated as dashes. She had tucked it under the mattress of her bed for safekeeping. Now, she finally had a whole free evening. Poppy and Granny were both asleep, and the apartment was tidy. Lina sat down at her table and uncovered the patched-together document. She tied back her hair so it wouldn't keep falling in her face, and she put a piece of paper next to her, blank except for a little bit of Poppy scribbling, to write down what she decoded. She started with the title. The first word she'd already figured out. It had to be instructions. The next word could be for. Then came Eagers. She wasn't sure about that. Maybe it was someone's name. Eagersman, Eagerston. Instructions for Eagerston. She decided to call it The Instructions for short. She went on to the first line. This off ick doc probably meant this official document. Maybe seeker meant secure or security. Then there were the words period and ears and city. But after that, so much was missing. She studied the line next to the number one. EXP period. That could be expect or expert or so many things. She moved on to RIV. That might be part of a word like drive or strive. What could IP and ORC possibly be? They were so close together, maybe they were part of one word. What ended with IP? Whip, Lina thought. Trip, slip. What ended with ORC? Fork came to mind immediately. Trip fork, slip fork. Nothing she could think of made sense. Maybe it wasn't fork. What else ended in ORC? Starting at the beginning of the alphabet, Lina went through all the words that rhymed with fork. Most of them were nonsense. Bork, dork, gork, hork, jork. This isn't going to work, she thought miserably. Oh, work! The word could be work! But then, what would the first part be? Trip work? Flip work? But maybe there was a letter between the P and the W. Gyps work, pips work. Suddenly it came to her. Pipeworks. Pipeworks, that had to be it. Something in this message was about the pipeworks. Lina looked back at exp and riv. Riv, that could be river. Rapidly, she ran her eyes down the page. In line 3, she saw iverb NK. But that looked like riverbank. The word door jumped out at her from line 4, hole on its scrap of paper. Lina took a quick breath. A door. What if it was the one she'd wished for? The one that led to the other city? Maybe her city was real after all, and these were instructions for finding it. She wanted to leap from her chair and shout. The message had something to do with the river, a door, and the pipeworks. And who did she know who knew about the pipeworks? Dune, of course. She pictured his thin, serious face and his eyes looking out searchingly from beneath his dark eyebrows. She pictured how he used to bend over his work at school, holding his pencil in a hard grip, and how, during free time, he was usually off by himself in a corner, studying a moth or a worm or a taken-apart clock. That was one thing, at least, that she liked about Dune. He was curious. He paid attention to things. And he cared about things, too. She remembered how he'd been on assignment day, so furious at the mayor, so eager to trade his good job for her bad one, so he could help save the city. And he'd taken Poppy inside his father's shop on the day of the blackout, so she wouldn't be afraid. Why had she stopped being friends with Dune? She vaguely recalled the incident of the light pole. It seemed silly now and long ago. The more she thought about Dune, the more it seemed he was the very person, the only person, who might be interested in what she had found. She placed the plain sheet of paper over the instructions and put the box on top. I'll go and find Dune, she thought. Tomorrow was Thursday, their day off. She would find him tomorrow and ask for his help. Chapter 8, Explorations. Dune had taken to wandering the pipeworks alone. He would go to his assigned tunnel and do his job quickly. Once you got good at using your wrenches and brushes and tubes of glue, it wasn't hard. Most of the workers did their jobs quickly, then gathered in little groups to play cards or have salamander races, or just talk and sleep. But Dune didn't care about any of that. If he was going to be stuck in the pipeworks, he would at least not waste the time he had. Since the long blackout, Everything seemed more urgent than ever. Whenever the lights flickered, he was afraid the ancient generator might be shuddering to a permanent halt. So while the others lounged around, he headed out toward the edges of the pipeworks to see what he could see. "Pay attention," his father had said, and that's what he did. He followed his map when he could, but in some places the map was unclear. There were even tunnels that didn't show up on the map at all. To keep from getting lost, he dropped a trail of things as he walked. Washers, bolts, pieces of wire, whatever he had in his tool belt. And then he picked them up on his way back. His father had been at least a little bit right. There were interesting things in the pipeworks if you paid attention. Already, he had found three new crawling creatures. A black beetle the size of a pinhead, a moth with furry wings, and the best of all, a creature with a soft, shiny body and a small, spiral-patterned shell on its back. Just after he found this one, while he was sitting on the floor watching in fascination as the creature crept up his arm, a couple of workers came by and saw him. They burst into laughter.
"It's Bug Boy," one of them said. "He's collecting bugs for his lunch."
Enraged, Dune jumped up and shouted at them. His sudden motion made the creature fall off his arm to the ground, and Dune felt a crunch beneath his foot. The laughing workers didn't notice. They tossed a few more taunts at him and walked on, but Dune knew instantly what he'd done. He lifted his foot and looked at the squashed mess underneath.
"Unintended consequences," he thought miserably.
He was angry at his anger, the way it surged up and took over. He picked the bits of shell and goo off the sole of his boot and thought, "I'm sorry. I didn't mean to hurt you." In the days that followed, Dune went farther and farther into the pipeworks, holding on to the hope that he might find something not only interesting, but important. But what he found didn't seem important at all. Once he came upon an old pair of pliers that someone had dropped and left behind. Twice he found a coin. He discovered a supply closet that appeared to have been completely forgotten, but all it held were some boxes of plugs and washers and a rusty box containing shriveled bits of what must once have been someone's lunch. He found another supply closet at the far south end of the pipeworks. At least, he assumed that's what it was. It was at the end of a tunnel with a rope strung across it. A sign hanging from the rope said, "Caved in, no entry." Dune entered anyway, ducking under the rope. He found no sign of a cave-in, but there were no lights. He groped his way forward for 20 steps or so, and there the tunnel ended in a securely locked door. He couldn't see it, but he felt it. He retraced his steps, ducked back under the rope again, and walked on. A short distance away, he found a hatch in the ceiling of the tunnel, a square wooden panel that must lead, he thought, up into the storerooms. If he'd had something to stand on, he could have reached it and tried to open it, but it was about a foot above his upstretched hand. Probably it was locked anyhow. He wondered if the builders had used openings like this one during the construction of the city to get more easily from one place to another. On days when his job was near the main tunnel, he sometimes walked along the river after he'd finished working. He stayed away from the east end where the generator was. He didn't want to think about the generator. Instead, he went the other way, toward the place where the river rushed out of the pipeworks. The path grew less level at this end and less smooth. The river here was bordered with clumps of wrinkled rock that seemed to grow out of the ground like fungus. Dune liked to sit on these clumps, running his fingers along the strange creases and crevices that must have been carved somehow by running or dripping water. In some places, there were grooves that looked almost like writing. But as for things of importance, Dune found none. It seemed that the pipeworks was no use after all to a person who wanted to save the city. The generator was hopeless. He would never understand electricity. He used to think he could use electricity to invent a movable light, if he studied hard enough. He took apart light bulbs. He took apart the electric outlets on the wall to see how the wires inside wound together, and in the process, got a painful, vibrating jolt all through his body. But when he tried to wind wires of his own together in exactly the same way, nothing happened. It was what came through the wires that made the light, he finally understood, and he had no idea what that was. Now he could see only two courses of action. He could give up and do nothing, or he could start to work on a different kind of movable light. Dune didn't want to give up, so on his day off one Thursday, he went to the Ember Library to look up fire. The library occupied an entire building on one side of Bilbalio Square. Its door was at the end of a short passage in the middle of the building. Dune went down the passage, pushed open the door, and walked in. No one was there except for the librarian, ancient Edward Pocket, who sat behind his desk, writing something with a tiny pencil clutched in his gnarled hand. The library had two big rooms, one for fiction, which was stories people made up out of their imaginations, and the other for fact, which was information about the real world. The walls of both rooms were lined with shelves, and on most of the shelves were hundreds of packets of pages. Each packet was held together with stout loops of string. The packets leaned against each other at angles and lay in untidy stacks. Some were thick, and some were so slim that only a clip was needed to hold them together. The pages of the oldest packets were yellowed and warped, and their edges were uneven rows of ripples. These were the books of Ember, written over the years by its citizens. They contained in their close-written pages much that was imagined and everything that was known. Edward Pocket looked up and nodded briefly at Dune, one of his most frequent visitors. Dune nodded back. He went into the fact room, to the section of shelves labeled F. The books were arranged by subject, but even so, it wasn't easy to find what you wanted. A book about moths, for instance, might be under M for moths, or I for insects, or B for bugs. It might even be under F for flying things. Usually you had to browse through the entire library to make sure you'd found all the books on one subject, but since he was looking for fire, he thought he might as well start with F. Fire was rare in Ember. When there was a fire, it was because there had been an accident. Someone had left a dish towel too close to an electric burner on a stove, or a cord had frayed and a spark had flown out and ignited curtains. Then the citizens would rush in with buckets of water, and the fire was quickly drowned. But it was, of course, possible to start a fire on purpose. You could hold a sliver of wood to the stove burner until it burst into flame, and then for a moment it would flare brightly, giving off orange light. The trick was to find a way to make the light last. If you had a light that would keep going, you could go out into the unknown regions and see what was there. Finding a way to explore the unknown regions was the only thing Dune could think of to do. He took down a book from the F shelf. Fungus, it was called. He put it back. The next book was called How to Repair Furniture. He put that back, too. He went through foot diseases, fun with string, coping with failure, and canned fruit recipes before he finally found a book called All About Fire. He sat down at one of the library's square tables to read it. But the person who had written the book knew no more about fire than Dune. Mostly the book described the dangers of fire. A long section of it was about a building in Winifred Square that had caught fire 40 years ago, and how all its doors and all its furniture had burned up and smoke had filled the air for days. Another part was about what to do if your oven caught on fire. Dune closed the book and sighed. It was useless. He could write a better book than that. He got up and wandered restlessly around the library. Sometimes you could find useful things just by choosing randomly from the shelves. He'd done this many times, just reached out and grabbed something, in the hope that, by accident, he might come upon the very piece of information he needed. It would be something that another person had written down without understanding its significance. Just a sentence or two that would be like a flash of light in Dune's mind, fitting together with things he already knew to make a solution to everything. Although he'd often found something interesting in these searches, he'd never found anything important. Today was no different. He did come across a collection called Mysterious Words from the Past, which he read for a while. It was about words and phrases so old that their meanings had been forgotten. He read a few pages. Heavens above indicates surprise. What heavens means is unclear. It might be another word for floodlight. Hogwash means nonsense, though no one knows what a hog is or why one would wash it. Batting 1,000 indicates great success. This might possibly refer to killing bugs. All in the same boat means all in the same predicament. The meaning of boat is unknown. Interesting, but not useful. He put the book back on the shelf and was about to leave when the door of the library opened and Lina Mayfleet came in. Chapter 9. The Door in the Roped-Off Tunnel. Lina saw Dune immediately. He was reaching up to set a book back on its shelf. He saw her, too, when he turned around, and his dark eyebrows flew up in surprise as she hurried over to him.
"Your father told me you were here," she said. "Dune, I found something. I want to show it to you."
"To me? Why?"
"I think it's important. It has to do with the pipeworks. Will you come to my house and see it?"
"Now?"
Dune asked. Lina nodded. Dune grabbed his old brown jacket and followed Lina out of the library and across the city to Quilliam Square. Granny's shop was closed and dark when they arrived, and so Lina was surprised when they went upstairs and saw Eveline Murdo sitting in her place by the window.
"Your grandmother's in her bedroom," Mrs. Murdo said. "She didn't feel well, so she asked me to come."
Poppy was sitting on the floor, banging a spoon on the leg of a chair. Lina introduced Dune, then led him into the room she shared with Poppy. He looked around, and Lina felt suddenly self-conscious, seeing her room through his eyes. It was a small room with a lot crammed into it. There were two narrow beds, a very small table that fit into a corner, and a four-legged stool to sit on. On the wall, clothes hung from hooks, and more clothes were strewn untidily on the floor. Beneath the window was a brown stain made by the bean seed in its pot on the windowsill. Lina had been watering it every night because she'd promised Clary she would. But it was still nothing but dirt, flat and unpromising. A couple of shelves beside the window held Lina's important possessions, the pieces of paper she'd collected for drawing, her pencils, a scarf with a silver thread woven through it. On the parts of the wall that had no hooks and no shelves, she had pinned up some of her pictures.
"What are those?" Dune asked.
"They're from my imagination," Lina said, feeling slightly embarrassed. "They're pictures of another city."
"Oh, you made it up."
"Sort of. Sometimes I dream of it."
"I draw too," said Dune, "but I draw other kinds of things."
"Like what?"
"Mostly insects," said Dune.
He told her about his collection of drawings and the worm he was currently observing. To Lina, this sounded far less interesting than an undiscovered city, but she didn't say so. She led Dune over to the table.
"Here's what I want to show you," she said.
She lifted the metal box. Before she could reach for the papers underneath, Dune took the box and started examining it.
"Where did this come from?" he asked.
"It was in the closet," Lina said.
She told him about Granny's wild search and about finding the box with its lid open and Poppy with paper in her mouth.
As she talked, Dune turned the box over in his hands, opened and closed its lid, and peered at the latch.
"There's some sort of odd mechanism here," he said.
He tapped at a small metal compartment at the front of the box.
"I'd like to see inside this."
"Here's what was in the box," said Lina, lifting the covering paper from her patchwork of scraps. "At least, that's what's left of what was in there."
Dune bent over, his hands on either side of the paper. Lina said, "It's called Instructions for Egerston, or maybe Egersman, someone's name anyhow. Maybe a mayor or a guard. I just call it the instructions. I told the mayor about it. I thought maybe it was important. I wrote him a note, but he hasn't answered. I don't think he's interested."
Dune said nothing.
"You don't have to hold your breath," said Lina. "I glued the pieces down. Look," she said, pointing. "This word must be pipeworks, and this one river. And look at this one, door."
Dune didn't answer. His hair had fallen forward, so Lina couldn't see the expression on his face.
"I thought at first," Lina went on, "that it must be instructions for how to do something, how to fix the electricity, maybe. But then I thought, what if it's instructions for going to another place?"
Dune said nothing, so Lina went on.
"I mean, some place that isn't here, like another city. I think these instructions say, go down into the pipeworks and look for a door."
Dune brushed the hair back from his face, but he didn't straighten up. He gazed at the broken words and frowned.
"Edge," he murmured. "Small steel pan. What would that mean?"
"A frying pan?" said Lina. "But I don't know why there'd be a frying pan in the pipeworks."
But Dune didn't answer. He seemed to be talking to himself. He kept reading, moving a finger along the lines of words.
"Open," he whispered. "Follow."
Finally, he turned to look at Lina.
"I think you're right," he said. "I think this is important."
"Oh, I was sure you'd think so," Lina cried. She was so relieved that her words poured out in a rush. "Because you take things seriously. You told the truth to the mayor on assignment day. I didn't want to believe it, but then came the long blackout and I knew things were as bad as you said."
She stopped, breathless. She pointed to a word on the document.
"This door," she said. "It has to be a door that leads out of Ember."
"I don't know," said Dune. "Maybe. Or a door that leads to something important, even if it isn't that."
"But it must be that. What else could be important enough to lock up in a fancy box?"
"Well, I suppose it could be a storage room with some special tools in it or something."
A look of surprise came over his face.
"Actually, I saw a door where I didn't expect to see one, out in Tunnel 351. It was locked. I thought it was an old supply closet. I wonder if that could be it."
"It must be," cried Lina. Her heart sped up.
"It wasn't anywhere near the river,"
Dune said doubtfully.
"That doesn't matter," Lina said. "The river goes through the pipeworks, that's all. It's probably something like, go down by the river, then go this way, then that way."
"Maybe," said Dune.
"It must be," Lina cried. "I know it is. It's the door that leads out of Ember."
"I don't know if that makes sense," said Dune. "A door in the pipeworks could only lead to something underground, and how could that?"
Lina had no patience for Dune's reasoning. She wanted to dance around the room, she was so excited.
"We have to find out," she said. "We have to find out right away."
Dune looked startled.
"Well, I can go and try the door again," he said. "It was locked before, but I suppose..."
"I want to go too," said Lina.
"You want to come down into the pipeworks?"
"Yes. Can you get me in?"
Dune thought for a moment.
"I think I can. If you come just at quitting time and wait outside the door, I'll stay out of sight until everyone is gone, and then I'll let you in."
"Tomorrow?"
"Okay. Tomorrow."
Lina stopped at home the next day, only long enough to change out of her messenger jacket, and then she dashed across town to the pipeworks. Dune met her just outside the door, and she followed him inside, where he handed her a slicker and boots to put on. They descended the long stone stairway, and when they came out into the main tunnel, Lina stood still, staring at the river.
"I didn't know the river was so big," she said, after she found her voice.
"Yes," said Dune. "Every few years, they say someone falls in. If you fall in, there's no hope of fishing you out. The river swallows you and sweeps you away."
Lina shivered. It was cold down here, a cold she felt all the way through. Cold flesh, cold blood, cold bones. Dune led her up the path beside the water. After a while, they came to an opening in the wall, and they turned into it and left the river behind. Dune led the way through winding tunnels. Their rubber boots splashed in pools of water on the floor. Lina thought how awful it would be to work down here all day, every day. It was a creepy place, a place where it seemed people didn't belong. That black river, it was like something in a bad dream.
"You have to duck here," said Dune.
They had come to a roped-off tunnel.
"But there's no light in there," Lina said.
"No," said Dune. "We have to feel our way. It isn't far."
He ducked under the rope and went in, and Lina did the same. They stepped forward into the dark. Lina kept a hand against the damp wall and placed her feet carefully.
"It's right here," said Dune.
He had stopped a few feet ahead of Lina. She came up behind him.
"Put your hands out," he said. "You'll feel it."
Lina felt a smooth, hard surface. There was a round metal knob, and below the knob, a keyhole. It seemed an ordinary door, not at all like the entrance to a new world. But that was what made things so exciting. Nothing was ever how you expected it to be.
"Let's try it," she whispered.
Dune took hold of the knob and twisted.
"Locked," he said.
"Is there a pan anywhere?"
"A pan?"
"The instructions said, small steel pan. Maybe that would have the key in it."
They felt around, but there was nothing, just the rocky walls. They patted the walls, they put their ears to the door, they jiggled the knob and pulled it and pushed it. Finally, Dune said,
"Well, we can't get in. I guess we better go."
And that was when they heard the noise. It was a scuffling, scraping noise that seemed to be coming from somewhere nearby. Lina stopped breathing. She clutched Dune's arm.
"Quick," Dune whispered.
He made his way back toward the lighted tunnel, with Lina following. They ducked under the rope and rounded a turn, then stopped, stood still, and listened. A harsh scraping sound. A thud. A pause. And then the sound of an impact. A short, explosive breath. And a muttered word in a gruff, low voice. Then slow footsteps getting closer. They flattened themselves against the wall and stood motionless. The footsteps stopped briefly, and there was another grunt. Then the steps continued, but seemed to be fading. In a moment, from a distance, there was another sound. The chink of a key turning in a lock, and the click of a latch opening. Lina made an astonished face at Dune. Someone had gone down the roped tunnel and opened the door. She put her mouth close to Dune's ear.
"Shall we try to see who it is?" she whispered.
Dune shook his head.
"I don't think we should," he said. "We should go."
"We could just peek around the corner."
It was too tempting not to try. They crept forward to the place where the tunnel turned. From there, they could see the entrance to the roped tunnel. Holding their breath, they watched. And in a minute, they heard a thump and click. The door closing, the lock turning, and footsteps once again, this time quick. A long leg stepped over the rope, and the person it belonged to turned and walked away. All they saw was his back, a dark coat, dark, untidy hair. He walked with a lurching motion that struck Lina as somehow familiar. In a few seconds, he had vanished into the shadows. When they came up out of the pipeworks, they stripped off their boots and slickers and hurried out into Plummer Square, where they flopped down on a bench and burst into furious talk.
"Someone got there before us," said Lina.
Dune said, "He was walking slowly when he went in, as if he was looking for something, and he walked fast when he came out,
as if he'd found something. What was it? I can't stand not to know."
Dune jumped up. He paced back and forth in front of the bench.
"But how did he get the key?"
he asked.
"Did he find instructions like the ones you found? And how did he get into the pipeworks? I don't think he works there."
"There's something familiar about the way he walks," said Lina.
"But I don't know why."
"Well, anyhow, he opened that door and we can't," said Dune. "If it does go somewhere, if it does lead out of Ember, he'll be telling the whole city pretty soon. He'll be a hero."
Dune sat down again.
"If he's found the way out, we'll be glad, of course," he said glumly. "Doesn't matter who finds it, as long as it helps the city."
"That's right," Lina said.
"It's just that I thought we were going to find it," said Dune.
"Yes," Lina said, thinking how grand it would have been to stand before all of Ember, announcing their discovery.
They sat without talking for a while, lost in their own thoughts. A man pulling a cart full of wood scraps went by. A woman leaned from a lighted window on Gapperee Street and called out to some boys playing in the square below. A couple of guards in their red and brown uniforms ambled across the square, laughing. The town clock rang out six deep booms that Lina could feel like shudders beneath her ribs.
Dune said, "I guess what we do now is wait to see if there's an announcement."
"I guess so," said Lina.
"Maybe that door is nothing special after all," said Dune. "Maybe it's just an old, unused supply closet."
But Lina wasn't ready to believe that. Maybe it wasn't the door out of Ember, but it was a mystery nevertheless. A mystery connected, she was sure, to the bigger mystery they were trying to solve.